You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I know everybody's probably had a wonderful week and is very well rested after a smooth and seamless election and just no stress there, perfect fun and happy. And so to talk about that stress-free, relaxing election, I have one of my good friends, Hannah Cox. She's a libertarian conservative journalist, criminal justice reform activist, and commentator. She also hosts the podcast Based on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Hannah, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Brad. I'm so excited to be here. You've been killing it with this.
So how was this week for you? I mean, did you have a heart attack at any point? Did you expect this kind of chaos?
I think I did expect it. So I've been kind of chill. Like, I have an anxiety disorder, so I always sort of can see how things will go in about 10 different directions. And so I'm not surprised at all about how this week has been. And I think that's let me be pretty laid back as a whole. I totally anticipated a long, drawn-out voting count process. You know, there's a lot going on leading up to the election that I was watching where we knew certain states were extending how many days they could keep counting for. They were blocking the poll counters from being able to start before the election for things that had already come in. So I anticipated this. I don't think I anticipated it being quite this close. I thought that we'd see a little bit more of an indication that the country was picking Biden or Trump. So I am surprised at the margins. I thought that there would be a contested election in certain states. So I anticipated the legal battles. But I will say it has still been a stressful time. I hate seeing my country torn apart. I hate seeing so much divisiveness and partisanship. I feel really sorry for people who I think put too much faith in politics and government in the first place, who really are greatly distressed over this. And so as a whole, it's not a good week for us.
Well, no, I completely agree. And I feel the same way. I honestly maybe was surprised by more of it than you. And then I expected, because I was dumb enough to believe the polls, or at least kind of believe them. And those guys need to learn to code, as Ben Shapiro said. They got a lot of stuff wrong, particularly when it comes to states like Ohio and Florida. You're talking about like 15 points the pollsters were off in Ohio. Right. So a lot of us were caught off guard by that. And I was also caught off guard by the way that Trump did a lot better with Hispanics and Black voters and LGBT voters. He got 28% compared to 13% in 2016. So a lot of this came out of nowhere, but I was always expecting it to come down to, like you said, Pennsylvania. I was always expecting the mail-in ballots to come in late and skew Democrat, because that's not a surprise. Trump told his people, don't vote mail-in. And then, of course, the mail-ins are going to be Democrat. So crazy week, but I can't say that any of it is there's no shocking anymore. Nothing shocking.
That's right. We knew the battleground states. I felt pretty certain that Michigan would flip. I thought that Wisconsin would probably flip back. I didn't feel as sure about Arizona. I'm surprised Georgia's in play. I have not agreed that it's in swing state territory up until now. So that was one place I was definitely wrong and not anticipating. But I'm actually not surprised that he picked up votes in the Hispanic community or in the LGBTQ community. I think at the end of the day, people are misled about why people vote and what drives their vote. And at the end of the day, there is no argument that Trump's economic policy is better for most people. I don't know anyone in my sphere that it's not, you know, across wide socioeconomic differences. We just know that the economy has done so much better under his policies. And you know, that's one thing to his credit. He did focus on deregulation. He did focus on tax cuts. He was focusing on things that created a better business climate for us. And it worked. And I think at the end of the day, that's the bottom line for people, especially right now during COVID, when government lockdowns have taken away so many people's livelihoods, right, their businesses. They've stripped away everything they've worked for overnight in the blink of an eye with no process whatsoever for people to get restitution for that or anything. So I think that's why people are voting in that way. I think they recognize that. And a lot of people can't stand many things about Trump, but at the end of the day, they're not going to go vote to make their economic prospects worse.
Right. And part of it, too, is that a lot of the things we expect to bother people about Trump, they don't even know about, because regular people don't follow Trump's every tweet and every news cycle that hits us in kind of the journalistic and punditry class. So a lot of the stuff that they do feel is Supreme Court, tax cuts, all of this, the economy, the coronavirus, those are the things that ultimately determine people's votes. Whereas the Twitter controversies and the offensive statements, I mean, most of the public doesn't even hear about those things. So it is interesting, but let's shift gears and talk about, look, we were all surprised by this result. It's come out a lot closer. It's still not called by most networks, but it does look like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are going to be the next president and vice president of the United States. So what do you make of their potential administration heading into divided government with Republicans probably in control of the Senate and a razor-thin Democrat majority in the House? How ambitious will it be? How far to the left will it be? And are you worried?
Well, I was talking with a former colleague of mine this week, and he said that he was teaching his 11-year-old son about gridlock and the beauty of it. And as he put it, gridlock is the second best outcome to liberty, which I don't think we had an option of on either of the two major party tickets this year. So I'm with him. I'm going to be pleased if we end up with a divided government. I think that means they can get far less done. Doesn't mean they can't get anything done. But certainly, I think that will be restraining to Biden and Harris's worst instincts. So I think that we definitely could have come out a lot worse. I think it's very interesting that Republicans were pretty dominant in holding their House seats and holding their Senate seats. That's something that you wouldn't necessarily anticipate if Biden was winning in large margins. I mean, most voters, when they vote down ballot, right? They typically vote straight ticket. So to me, that says maybe people are thinking through this a bit more and they're recognizing they want, you know, Trump to get out. They don't like his worst instincts. They don't like the rhetoric. They don't like the constant hysteria in this country, but they also don't want the Democrats to get to push through their agenda and policies. So I think that's an interesting turnout. As a whole, you know, I was going to be displeased no matter who won and for different reasons. I think Biden and Harris have, they're going to have terrible economic ideas and policies. I think that if they are able to get through through executive orders or other actions, some of their worst instincts, then we're definitely going to see businesses hurt. We're going to see talent leave. We're going to see a decline in our economic growth and in our job sector. I don't think it's going to be a pretty picture for us. And that's a really, really big deal. And that's a sad prospect for the next 4 years. That being said, you know, as somebody who leans libertarian, I think there's issues I can agree with Democrats on. I don't always feel Democrats live up to their rhetoric on the issues we agree on. But if they were to look at reforming our immigration system, making it easier and simpler for people to come here legally, do the right thing, start paying taxes, work, and pursue their version of the American dream, I'd love to see that happen. I'd love to work with anybody to make that happen. I think the immigration policy under Trump was one of the aspects that made a hard red line in the sand for me, where I would never have supported right. him because ethically and economically, I thought it was completely asinine and awful. So I'm excited if that's the case. I think while they both have a very checkered past around criminal justice reform, one thing is dominant this year. Criminal justice reform won on the ballot in every possible way it could have. In ballot measures, when the war on drugs was brought up and in prosecutorial races, we saw the voters speak. They want criminal justice reform. They want it across this country. This is my area of expertise. I know that that's true on the ground. And so while I don't think Biden and Harris are by any means the criminal justice champions or warriors I would have hoped for, I think they know that they have to be dominant in that area if they want to maintain support. And so hopefully we could get some really big criminal justice reform through, depending on whether or not a Republican Congress would ever work with them on that and let them get those wins. But it's a possibility. We'll see. So there's good and bad.
Yeah. So I hear what you're saying. And I've thought a little bit about this too, because I'm probably going to be out there battling against their economic policies and their regulation and their executive order and their government health care and all sorts of other stuff. But I'm not a partisan, and I'm not going to oppose anything Biden Harris do just because they're Democrats and have a donkey next to their name. I mean, that's not how honest brokers work. So I agree with you. I'll be interested to see what their plan is on immigration. And if they have a reasonable, comprehensive, pro-legal immigration reform that lets more people come here legally, lets non-violent, non-criminal people who are here illegally have a pathway to legal residency, I'll support all of that. But you brought up criminal justice, and I totally agree with you that the tide in America is ripe for criminal justice reform. Even Republicans like it. I mean, President Trump signed the First Step Act. That would have been unthinkable 20 years ago that Republicans would be supporting criminal justice reform. And it did win on the ballot big this election. But I'm very deeply skeptical that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will do anything beyond virtue signaling. They might kneel with scarves with Nancy Pelosi and tweet Black Lives Matter, But I mean, Joe Biden doesn't even support legalizing weed, and it's 2020. I mean, he was the author of the crime bill, 1994, that put a ton of black men in jail over nonviolent drug crimes. Kamala Harris threw people away and laughed and threw away the key. So I'm very pessimistic that the two of them in charge will lead to any serious reform on the criminal justice front. But I hope I'm wrong.
Well, and I think it's right to be skeptical. And I think we have to hold their feet to the fire, right? So often people use issues that are really popular like this or like ending the endless wars, and they don't actually mean it. They don't actually do anything to follow through on that after they're in office. And that's a problem across the spectrum. I will say, you know, at the end of the day, criminal justice reform is a battle at the state level. There is some things that need to be done at the federal level, but most of our criminal population is held throughout state prisons. And really what we need is a permission slip for lawmakers to really come in and affect radical change at that level. That's where the real battle is. Federally, there's some things they can do. You know, one thing that I think you could anticipate seeing is I do think the death penalty executions will stop that President Trump restarted for the first time in 16 years this year. I think that will go away. I think we could see some pushes to perhaps address sentencing. But I have to agree with you that I don't find Biden or Harris to be people who legitimately had a change of heart on this issue. And I say that as someone who did. Yeah, they changed because they recognized they needed to. You know, I used to be a little authoritarian neocon who loved Law and Order SVU and wanted to lock everybody up. So I understand I coming from Order, that. I do still love Elliot Stabler so hot.
Oh my
you can't
God.
Not like it. But that being said, you know, I really had a change of heart when I got around the system, when I saw the really serious repercussions, and when I started to understand what caused violence, and when I really understood the impacts of trauma, and then understood how we could intervene earlier on in people's life and prevent cyclical violence in our society and actually address underlying causes, I really fundamentally had a shift in how I address these issues. I haven't seen that from them. I haven't seen that in their policy proposals. I don't know that they either one get it yet. And so I think it's right to be skeptical, but hopefully there will be an open door for people who do get it and for people who have been working on this issue for decades to come in and write the policies.
Here's why I think there's not an actual transition in their views. They're going to go with the tide. I agree with you. They're going to have to accommodate where the Democrat base is at. But ultimately, Kamala Harris is somebody who views government as the solution to every issue. She views expanding her own power as necessary in any possible case. Whereas for me, it was like I started out convinced by small government principles and fiscal conservatism, and then learned that those applied best to criminal justice. Whereas it's like they're these big government people who view the state as kind of their go-to solution for everything, and then they have to kind of be pulled away by the masses from not applying that same approach to criminalize everything, lock everyone in jail. And I just don't think that their ideology, that kind of toxic big government, they're not total socialists, they're not Marxists, they're not true progressives. If they were, they'd probably be better on this issue, actually. But I think their kind of toxic centrist Democrat establishment view is really incompatible with believing in small government in the criminal justice reform system. So maybe they're pressured to do it anyway, but I think that's why it's probably so much of an inconsistency.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong in any way, shape, or form. And I actually do think that's why you saw a lot of progressives who did not support Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. You know, we really did see a lot of people break off and say, you know, I'm not backing the DNC. I don't believe in this approach. And I do think at their core, they are people who care about party first, power first, government first. And I don't see that changing. I really don't. But I'm an eternal optimist. And you know, again, criminal justice reform comes one bill at a time. It's inch by inch by inch. And we've achieved a lot going in that direction. And we will continue to. So at the end of the day, I don't think we're going to be getting a worse approach to criminal justice reform. But by no means do I want to indicate that I think we're going to get incredible criminal justice reform under this administration and things are going to look radically different. That's not going to happen. And it's never going to happen federally. It's going to happen at the state level. And so I think, again, it's important to look at the results of this election, what happened on ballot access or ballot amendments, what happened in local races, and to see that voters really do get what's happening around this and are pushing for change.
What were a couple of the big ones related to criminal justice for the listeners?
Well, to me, the Oregon package where they essentially decriminalized drugs was a massive achievement. That's the first state to ever do that in this country. That's following in the footsteps of Portugal, who did that a number of years ago. And it's what we really need to do in order to move drug use, which is a problem. Addiction is a major problem in our society, but to move it out of the criminal justice system, which will never be able to adequately address it or really cure it, and put it where it properly belongs, which is in a public health system. And so it's not legalizing the drugs. I've seen a lot of people mistaken about that online today. They're still not legal, but there is not a criminal penalty attached to them. And so when someone is apprehended using drugs, buying drugs, selling drugs, instead of being sent through the criminal justice system, there's going to be alternative pathways that actually provide them ways that they can start to really address underlying root causes of the addiction itself. And so I'm really excited to see what happens with that. I thought that was a really, really big deal. And I wrote recently about how the founding fathers meant for our states to be sort of mini laboratories, right? Where they could try different approaches to issues, see how it works. States could learn from each other. They could take on things that did work and were successful, and they could, walk away from things that weren't. And so I really think that's great to see Oregon doing that and to see how that moves forward for them, and then to see if other states pick that up and move in that direction.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. I've always thought that decriminalization is something that everyone should support. Conservatives should support decriminalization. I get that legalization is a harder sell, but the idea that the appropriate response to somebody using drugs is not to lock them in jail.
Right.
I am not a libertine. I don't think drug use is fine and dandy and give everybody, it's great, do whatever drugs you want. But I don't think criminalizing it helps anything. And I think there's just a mountain of evidence and lived reality that shows that it's only the war on drugs has totally failed by any empirical and just realistic view. So just criminalizing it is just punitive. It's not restorative and it doesn't fix the problem. So I hope that we do see that progress. But let's talk more about this question of liberty winning at the state and local level, which I think it has somewhat. I know we both are very big fans of Young Americans for Liberty, but they had a good night at this election, getting, I think, 90 plus liberty-oriented state and local legislators, including one official Libertarian Party state legislator elected to office. Now, what wasn't so successful is the National Libertarian Party presidential bid by Joe Jorgensen, the presidential nominee, and Spike Cohen, the vice presidential nominee. I believe they got just about 1% of the vote, and that's significantly down from Gary Johnson in 2016. So do you think that that broadly speaking, state and local is where it's got to start?
Absolutely. And I've always thought that, we decry federalism or the federal government growing and point to federalism as the way to better approach things. But so often we're delinquent in trying to actually come in and work at that level and get good people put into office there, holding them accountable at that level, and then also pushing good legislation there. There's very few people focused on that aspect of our government. And when you do that, I have found tremendous success. That's what my organization does. I don't go and lobby federally. I don't even talk to federal congressmen very often. I'm focused on state and local, and we have a lot of success. For the company I run, we've overturned the death penalty in 2 states in 2 years, and we're poised to do it in another in the next. So you really can get big things done there if you're paying attention. But it's not as glamorous. It's not as sexy. You don't get to go to DC and go to the cocktail parties. You're like at a barbecue in a barn. It's just not what people picture when they're thinking about politics. It's very different. But I love Young Americans for Liberty. I think they are so smart to focus on state house races. Most of these races you can win pretty affordably, under $100,000 typically in most of them. You only need a couple people outdoor knocking to really make a huge difference in getting out the grassroots support. And so that's what they've done. They've said, we have this amount of money, we have this amount of students that are working with us, we can go and really affect change in this number of races per year. And they've done it. They've done the work. They've rolled up their sleeves and they've now as a whole gotten, I think, close to 160 state house reps elected across this country. When you start working at those numbers, that makes all the difference. In New Hampshire, when I repealed the death penalty a couple of years ago, had it not been for the number of people Yale had gotten elected in their state house and Senate, we would not have been able to override the governor's veto. It's really hard to override a governor's veto. We did that with Republican supporters. So if it weren't for Young Americans for Liberty's coalitions in that state, we wouldn't have gotten our bill passed. And I think that will be true in other states as we progress as well. So it's really cool to see what they're doing. I think they have the right approach. When you look at the Libertarian Party, you know, I think there's some great people working within it. I personally really liked aspects of Joe Jorgensen's campaign and Spike Cohen. I thought they were talking about issues that we don't usually see libertarians address, specifically things around racial bias in our government, around criminal justice reform. They really were taking that on strongly, and I thought had great messaging around it. And I was pleased to support them. That being said, it was a tough year. You know, they didn't have great name recognition. 2016, although there were a lot of people that disagreed with Gary Johnson and Bill Weld being the nominees, they were former governors. People had heard of them. The media did give them more coverage. We just didn't see that this time around, and certainly saw a huge drop off in the numbers. So that was disappointing. But I think the Libertarian Party can grow from there and hopefully start focusing on local races in between the elections and see some success.
But don't they have to learn from that? Don't they have to look and say, you know, I have nothing against either Joe Jorgensen or Spike Cohen. They seem like lovely people, intelligent people, but neither of them had ever served political office. They had no typical politician qualifications of any kind. Now, maybe you and I think that shouldn't matter, right? But voters think that matters, right? So Gary Johnson was just taken much more seriously as a former governor, same with Bill Weld. And these people that Yale's getting elected to state office, maybe they can run for governor. Maybe one day they can run for president and have some credibility having served up the food chain, right? But when they picked people to run at the top of the ticket that had zero experience and zero name recognition, I mean, in my view, I said this at the time, they could be the smartest and most brilliant people in the world. That is an almost insurmountable hill to climb when you're starting with no qualifications and no name recognition, no?
Well, I think that's not wrong. But I also think if you look at who they had to choose from, I think they went with the most pragmatic, best messengers that were available to them. And the reality was the LP isn't attracting people of that caliber yet. And I think the idea that you just mentioned is right. You need to get those people elected at local, state positions, let them grow, let them get experience, and then start running them for higher office positions. I think that makes more sense. I think it's a more pragmatic approach. And I think, you know, I'm really excited to see what happens with Young Americans for Liberty as those guys grow and as they really progress in their leadership. I think that that could be an excellent model. But right now, you know, it's very hard to convince people to come run on the Libertarian ticket because right now you mostly know you're not going to win, right? And people who want run for office typically really want to win. You take out a lot of personal time, a lot of money to run for office. It's hard to sell it to somebody that they should do that if there's not a chance of their winning. So I'm hopeful that they can attract candidates of that caliber as we move forward. I remain very enthusiastic around Justin Amash. I was devastated when he decided not to run this year. I thought that this would have been a really good time for him to run. I mean, that would have been a great year for him to really step in and illustrate how similar the two parties actually operate a lot of the time and illustrate how little of a choice voters really had between the two and to really provide an example of somebody who was very different and who really did support free markets and limited government and individual liberty. So I was very sad. I do hope he doesn't go away. I think he's a great speaker, a great messenger, and really brilliant guy. But that's what's going to have to happen, I think, to really see the Libertarian Party get anywhere close to the threshold that they need, which is about 5%.
Yeah, and he had the name recognition and the qualifications. So it is a shame because I think he would have just had a different path in front of him. But and hear my hot take out for a second. I've been talking about this with a few people. I think that the Libertarian Party, I agree completely, they need to focus local, they need to take the Yale approach, and then over time, they can mount a more serious third-party presidential bid. In the meantime, if you're going to run a presidential bid, I think they need a celebrity. I think they need someone famous who can self-fund millions of dollars and is libertarian and people already know who they are. And I think that if you actually could, because right now the biggest hurdle to the Libertarian Party is not their ideas, but it's kind of the two-party duopoly and their minor party status, and they can't get in the debates, et cetera. So it's really hard to get media attention. It's really hard to even get the message out there. but you could almost leapfrog all of that. And I know it's easier said than done, convincing a famous person to run on your ticket. But I mean, imagine if you had Vince Vaughn or someone like that running for president. It'd be, or like, I think he's gone to the left a little bit, but The Rock, someone like that who could pour millions of dollars into a campaign like nothing, like Trump did in 2016. I think maybe that would be fun to watch, and maybe it might even work.
I think that's right. Libertarian ideas are actually very popular. That's why the other two parties have to run on them. You know, as far as civil liberties, as far as social policy goes, the Democrats come in and take what libertarians were saying since the 1970s and act like it's them leading. Republicans constantly talk about free markets, limited government, and don't actually adhere to it, but they have to, you know, they have to run like libertarians in order to win. And so certainly I think our ideas are not the problem. It is the intentional barriers that have been put into place that have suppressed knowledge of libertarians, knowledge of their values, knowledge of even who they are. There has been some serious PR issues over the years that need to be gotten a hold of. But I definitely agree. I think if they could get somebody with some really great name recognition just to go out and be a champion to help people understand why we don't have more options. I mean, if you look at polling, Americans say across the board that they want third parties. They want other options. Even Americans who are happy in their political home say that. So they would like to see that. They don't know why we haven't gotten it. And there are real reasons that people need to be educated about, not only at the national level, but also down ballot as well.
Yeah. And one thing that's interesting is that we're talking about one path of advancing liberty in the political sphere, but there's another path. And I think some people frame them as either or. I view them as they can coexist. But another one is just winning on specific issues in a libertarian direction. And I think that actually liberty-minded folks and libertarians have been successful on that front. When you think of kind of anti-interventionist or war-weary foreign policy, that has become more popular and more mainstream in recent years. So has drug decriminalization. So has support for gay marriage. So has support for criminal justice reform. So on a lot of these specific issues, I mean, libertarian ideas are really winning, even if they're having to go through the existing two-party system.
I think that's absolutely correct. And again, that's really been more of my approach, is to focus on policy wins. I think that it's a lot easier to chip things away in that manner, to really come in and to get people across the board to work with you. Because when you do that, you know, I get Democrats to work on my bills, I get Republicans to work on my bills, I get some libertarian support, and you really get broad coalitions. And I think you're also educating people about those values that they then can apply to other issues as they move forward as well. So I like that approach. I think it's a more realistic, incremental type way of winning. It doesn't feel as sexy, I think, to people. It doesn't feel as big. And the reality is most people don't pay attention to what's happening in the states outside of elections. You know, they pay attention to who wins the presidency. Yeah. Maybe they know what the president does from time to time, but they certainly don't know what their state legislature is passing. And so they don't get as excited because they just have no idea how much great stuff is happening and awful stuff is happening at that level. So I think that should be encouraging to people if they want to really get involved and be impactful. There's a lot of opportunity to do that over the next 4 years, no matter who ends up at the top of the ticket.
Right. And this kind of relates to one thing that you've written a lot about, and I think you're a very poignant voice on, which is this matter that Americans are at each other's throats more than ever, right? We don't understand each other. There's a huge perception gap between what Republicans think Democrats believe and what Democrats think Republicans believe. People live in silos and echo chambers and media ecosystems that just confirm their prior beliefs. They don't dialogue with people who have different views from them. They go straight to ad hominem. It's uber polarized, and elections on both sides are framed, as always, as the most important election of our lifetime. And it rarely is. But you talk about how federalism, a return to state and local decision making instead of do or die federal elections every 4 years or 2 years, is a solution. Can you talk about that as a path that you think could start to heal the national divide?
Yeah, well, I do think that this is driving a lot of our hyper partisanship, a lot of the animosity that we see in this country. The federal government was never supposed to be this big. We know that we have a very diverse country. Even, you know, just look at the geography of it. Look at, you know, in Arizona, you're in deserts, and where I'm at in South Carolina, you're on the coast. And if you're up in Seattle, it just all even looks very different. People have such different ways of lives. They have different ways of thinking about things. They have different religions. It is ridiculous ridiculous to think that a country this size, 330 plus million people, could have this one central government that can come in and control all of these aspects of their lives, their healthcare, their marriages, their adoptions, when they have kids. I mean, all of these things are so personal. And to think that the government can come in and influence those or take them away, of course that makes people angry and hate others. Of course they're going to be upset when somebody's vote has the ability to radically change your way of life, take away opportunities from you, make it harder to get things that you feel you need. That's going to create a country where we're at each other's throats. And that's why we were structured in a way where communities were really supposed to have so much more control over people's lives. And so that way you actually knew the people that you were working with to decide how you were going to run things. You knew each other, you understood each other. You didn't have this fear mongering or stereotyping that we so often see people have, because the reality is we don't know people differently than us. It's so unlikely that you have a close association with somebody who's of a different religion, of a different socioeconomic class, of a different race or ethnicity. We are so in our social bubbles. And so we don't understand where people are coming from. We don't understand their needs. We don't understand how things are impacting them in their day to day. And I'll use criminal justice reform as another example of that. You know, for me growing up, it was so hard for me to understand when people talked about racial bias or about police brutality, because that was not my experience. That was not happening in my community. And so I simply didn't believe them. I was not very empathetic to them because I didn't know people that impacted until I started working in the music industry and had colleagues who had been impacted in that way and who did have to have conversations with their sons that were very different than my parents had with me about how to act in society, how to handle police encounters. And it really sort of shook the foundation I stood on when I just had this total awakening of other people's experiences. And I think that that's why we should have localized control. There's this cooperation that breeds when you know people, when you care about them. And I think we can better come to compromise and solutions at that level. At the federal level, I doubt any of my senators or representatives throughout my life have ever even read any of my communications when I've sent them. I couldn't get them on the phone if I needed to. They don't know about my day-to-day life. So that's going to be a problem right away. And then you look at the expansion of government, how many areas it's involved in. It's messing with things it was never intended to mess with. They should have no say over a lot of the things that they are intervening in. And the only way to really retract any of this and start to pull back is if we were to return to that system of federalism.
You're right. And I love the idea. And I totally agree with you that if we were to return to it, it would take the national temperature down and it would let people start living with each other again. The problem is, I'm pretty skeptical that we ever can do it, because in order to return to federalism, both sides would have to let other people do things in their communities that they don't like. So, for example, Roe v. Wade would have to go, and California could keep its pro-abortion laws, but Texas would have to be allowed to pass restrictive abortion laws and pro-life. I don't think liberals would ever accept that the way it stands now. And vice versa, I don't think conservatives would accept that blue states should get to pass gun control laws or should get to pass wide-ranging LGBT rights laws about religious schools or anything else that it may be, or defunding police, whatever things they hate. It requires people to let other people do things they don't like. And it seems like we've lost any appetite for that in America today. So I love the idea, but I'm just pessimistic.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you whatsoever. I think you're 100% right. That is what freedom is, right? Freedom is not only having the choices and ability to pick your own pathway and decide what your life looks like, but it's recognizing that you don't get to necessarily have everything go the way you want around you. Freedom isn't perfect. It was never intended to say that you just everything's going to be great. There's negatives to freedom, but those are better outcomes, the negatives that come with freedom, than the negatives that come with central planning, which I think are far worse. But we do have to have a return to that recognition that freedom means I don't always like what's happening. Freedom means I'm not always benefited. You know, I think the debate over social media is a great example of people not being principled in that and not truly supporting freedom lately. I have to recognize that Twitter and Facebook are private businesses that I don't think have to host me. Same as I didn't think the baker had to bake the cake if it violated his religious liberty, I don't think Twitter and Facebook have to promote my views and give me a space to say what I want if it if it offends their views, it offends their business model, whatever it is, they have every right to kick me off. And the government should never come in there and try to manipulate that or force their hand or tell a private business how to run their business, who to do business with. And I have to be consistent in that and say, if I don't like how they're running their businesses, which I don't, then I need to use other competitors. I need to build better models. We need to compete in the market of ideas to win. That's freedom. I see both parties going in the opposite direction from that and not really taking a strong stance. And I see most Americans in that same camp. So I think that as many problems as I have with our government, it is a representative government. It is following us. Politics flows downstream from culture. And so if we don't like how things are going in this country, at the root cause of that is us. And we have to change and we have to be consistent and ask for better things if we expect our leaders to.
Well, that is a great note to leave the serious conversation on. Thank you for joining me today. And before I ask you our fun bonus question, just let everybody know where they can follow you and tell them about your new podcast.
Yeah. So my new podcast is called Based. I'm really excited about it. It's actually a vodcast. So it's available on my Facebook, which is Hannah Danielle Cox 7. It's available on YouTube, which is Hannah Cox 7. And it's also available on Spotify and on iTunes with Based with Hannah Cox. My Twitter is Hannah Cox 7. I'd love to connect with people there. I'm very active on Twitter. I love Twitter, actually. I have a great time. Everybody else hates Twitter.
Active on there.
I'm like, I actually have a good time here. But I'd love to connect with people and would really appreciate them checking out and sharing the podcast too.
For kind of our final question, tell us, what is your hot food take?
My hot food take. So I'm very different from you. I love following your food takes, but I love food. I'm a humongous foodie. I love trying new food. I get kind of obsessive when I find food I love. My only real like hard line in the sand is raw onions. I can't stand raw onions. They make me want to die. Like I have a very violent, dramatic reaction if somebody slips an onion into my food. And Brand was talking about his conspiracy around mayonnaise mayo. On your show. Yeah, mayo that people try to convince him to eat things that it's on and they think he won't notice. Mm-hmm. That happens with onions too. I swear, my mother, even ex-boyfriends of mine, everybody has always tried to slip onions in on me and they think I won't notice or pick up on it. And I mean, even the tiniest little bit of onion, like I will notice and I will want to throw up. I can't stand them. So aside from that, I'm really easy to please, but.
All right, everybody. That's Hannah Cox, who hates onions and loves liberty. Thanks for tuning into the show again. It's been great having you all here for another conversation this week. And we will talk again next Saturday.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.